even better than getting your rocks off with a girl.
That was terrifying. Today we're talking about Zodiac, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Edwards, Robert Downey Jr., Brian Cox, John Carroll Lynch, Chloe Sevigny, and also Jimmy Simpson in a very small role, who I didn't realize it was Jimmy Simpson until the last scene. Huh. Directed by David Fincher. I am Ryan, one of your hosts here.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Matthew.
And I'm Logan.
And we are back for our last review in this little section of David Fincher reviews, with one of his biggest movies, I would say, Zodiac. At least it was a huge deal at the time, and I think it has pervaded, I think, pretty well. So, guys, real quick, what are your backgrounds with Zodiac for anyone who hasn't listened to our previous episodes?
So, I have no background with the movie Zodiac, other than, you know, some of the actors. I love Jake Gyllenhaal and Robert Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo.
All MCU actors now.
MCU actors. That's pretty cool. I tried to say pretty crazy and also pretty cool.
At this point, who isn't an MCU actor? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it feels like everyone has been indoctrinated by now.
Basically.
That's fair. But I am, I was fairly familiar with the Zodiac case, which we'll actually be discussing on Twisted Bug Mysteries later this week. So,
any cool, keep your eyes open.
Yeah. So if you want to know more about that actual, the actual facts of the case and, some things that maybe the movie didn't go into, although this is, I must say, a very accurate recount of, the Zodiac Killer, case file. That was pretty much my experience with it.
So knowing, Brennan, real quick, before we get into everyone else's background, going into the movie, knowing it was being made by David Fincher and having seen these movies, Fincher's, before, up until this point, how did you feel going into it?
I've liked most of Fincher's movies, for the most part. I felt pretty good about it. I wasn't terribly sure, because, you know, you get a lot of these, like, movies made about serial killers and stuff. And they're really just embellished for the film, or, like, they take minute details that, like, really have no bearing on the actual case, and then they, like, try to skew your vision one way. And I think that, like, because Robert Graysmith was, like, a writer on this movie, it definitely is kind of a little bit skewed to fit his narrative of Lee being the Zodiac Killer, because that is wholeheartedly what he believes, and he has said that in his second book, which came out recently, not recently, but after this movie, I believe. But I was preparing for it to not be a completely accurate recount of the case, but the more I watched and then looked into it after the fact to see if they had embellished anything, they really did a pretty fine job of it, I would say.
Yeah, so I first saw this movie, I think it was 2015 or 2014, way back. I remember watching this with my cousin, I guess I was in eighth grade then, like in my basement. And I remember being absolutely terrified by this movie, but totally enthralled. I thought it was brilliant. It just took me by complete surprise. I guess that was probably the first Fincher movie I had seen at that point. But I just was blown away, and over the years my fondness for this movie has grown, and it is one of my favorite movies of all time. I think this movie is a masterpiece. That's what we'll get into. Fincher's style here, it's just brilliant. This is very much so a journalistic procedural drama in the vein of All the President's Men, which is also one of my favorite movies of all time. So this movie kind of just plays to all my interests. I don't know much about the actual real life facts of the Zodiac case, but from what Brendan said, it sounds like it's accurate. Even if this movie wasn't accurate, I would totally buy it, because it's totally entrancing. It totally hooks you in. And just like the characters who are, you know, totally sucked down this rabbit hole of obsession with no way out. I mean, that is us, the viewer. By the end of this movie, I believe that Arthur Lee Allen is the killer. And it's, I just find it so brilliant of a film.
So I had no experience with this movie. I'd only seen the other Fincher movies that we've seen, or that we've all discussed on this podcast, and, you know, liked some of them, didn't like some of them. So yeah, this was a totally fresh experience for me.
Yeah, I had seen this movie probably around the time that Matt did, maybe a little later, but definitely early high school. And I loved it, and I hadn't seen it since, despite being a fan of Fincher. I don't know what it was. It was a movie that I had saw and really enjoyed and just hadn't rewatched, but was very excited to be doing this series. This was one of the big movies that I was very excited to rewatch to be able to have an excuse to sit down and watch this almost 3-hour movie. So I was very excited to rewatch it. I'm very excited to talk about it now. So I will go into a little plot summary via IMDb that we can get into the movie. A serial killer in the San Francisco Bay Area taunts police with his letters and cryptic messages. We follow the investigators and reporters in this lightly fictionalized account of the true 1970s case as they search for the murderer, becoming obsessed with the case. Based on Robert Graysmith's book, the movie's focus is the lives and careers of the detectives and newspaper people. And that is the basic plot of David Fincher's Zodiac. So we got Matt's initial impression. It's one of his favorite movies of all time. But Brennan and Logan, how'd you feel about Zodiac?
I really like this movie. I thought, you know, going into it, I saw that this was like a 2.5 like hour movie, and I was like, oh god, that's really long. But I was enthralled pretty much the whole way through. The acting was really great, and just like everything about it was really interesting to me, and I had no problem sitting through it for that entire runtime.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was, I sort of forgot to mention this with my background coming into it, but I pretty much have no knowledge of the Zodiac case at all. And yeah, no, I found it very interesting. Found it, very engaging. Definitely doesn't feel like 2.5 hours. Definitely props to the movie for that. I think Fincher's style in this one is. Really the thing that comes through for me. I think Fincher's style is absolutely, it's really taking form. He's had a style the whole way, but I think now this is, you know, Fincher distilled. I think it's a really, really cool film here. Yeah.
Yeah, I love this movie on rewatch. I thought it's fantastic. It's still not quite probably my favorite Fincher movie. I think Seven's gonna hold that for all time. I love Seven so much. But no, yeah, this film's fantastic, and like you guys said, it is very procedural in many ways, but I think in specific ways it is also very personal, and it shows very personal horrors, even beyond the murder scenes, which are intense. But
brutal.
Yeah, this might be Fincher's most bleak, most haunting, maybe. Maybe besides the very ending of Seven. But no, yeah, this movie feels maybe unlike any of his other movies, just so hopeless by the end of it. Even with Jake Gyllenhaal's character maybe figuring it out, maybe not. For me, this feels like a very bleak ending and a very bleak film, despite its decent emotional connection to characters, which you can't always say for David Fincher's movies. Sometimes he does like to keep, you know, an arm's length from his characters, but I think here, maybe he keeps like a half an arm's length. Like he lets you in a little bit. But I really enjoyed this movie. And like you guys said, this movie does not feel like it's 2 hours and 40 minutes at all. Yeah. Not at all.
Something interesting you said was keeping his characters at arm's length. I really felt like with this film in particular, I actually felt like a sort of attachment to some of these characters. Like I was actually feeling, maybe not for the first time, I think maybe we got a little bit of attachment to the characters in Panic Room, but I think this is definitely the strongest, it's the most heart that a Fincher movie has ever had for me. And mm-hmm. Heart doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be, you know, a bright, sunshiny, happy ending movie, which it is absolutely not. But, you know, there is a heart to it, and that is something that I was thinking about with Fight Club a lot. It didn't feel like there was any real heart or soul to the movie. It was just kind of a technically well-made, very cold, cold piece of
Maybe work. This isn't as bleak as Fight Club. I kind of, yeah, probably not, sorry.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Second.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know necessarily about bleakness, but it feels like there is connection to these characters, you know, and that's really important, and I think that's what Fincher's sort of starting to get as he goes on.
Very much so. And it's not that these characters are painted as wholeheartedly good. You know, Fincher recognizes these flaws, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal, his obsession, how it ruins his marriage and so on and so forth. But I think he really does. He's very interested in these characters. And like those characters, I would say he's very obsessed with them. Because, you know, just, you know, like with the characters, like the whole Zodiac crime spree, this movie feels obsessive. All of Fincher's films feel very obsessive. And I mean, that's one of his main themes, Social Network, obsession. That's you know, Gone Girl obsession. And I feel like this movie, Logan, you talked about his style. This really, for me, marks Fincher's modern style. And I think from here on out, although I haven't seen Benjamin Button, so maybe that's an exception. But from here on out, I really do feel like all his movies have this very, very slick, the blue lighting, this look to it kind of carries on throughout. I think it's beautiful to look at.
Yeah, and there's a moment in there when I'm not sure who it is. I think it's I'm not sure of the character's name. It's Mark Ruffalo's partner. He like says that he's going to retire or something.
Oh.
And it's a genuinely you know, touching moment. We actually feel for these characters because they have emotions and we feel that they have lives. You know, it's not just like we're not really keeping them at an arm's length. We are getting to see into these characters, which isn't, you know, it's not something that I especially would have said that is very important to me before doing this Fincher series, but I think having been starved for that in past movies, I have really come to appreciate it in this one.
Oh, gee, that's one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful acting. I believe it's Anthony Edwards is the actor's name. I don't remember what the character's name is, though.
Yeah, let's. That is a great scene, but I do want to start at the beginning, as we always do here. It's a good place to start.
Yes.
So the first 45 minutes to an hour, I think, of this movie, I was trying to keep track because I'd seen the movie before, so I didn't feel bad about checking time codes and where we were in the movie. I think the first 45 minutes to an hour was the initial Zodiac run, like the killings, the initial shock of everything happening in Vallejo in San Francisco. And so for the first bit while these first murders are going on, we're just with Robert Downey Jr. and Jake Gyllenhaal getting to know these two characters for like the first half an hour before Mark Ruffalo's character comes into it. And I think this is the strongest part of the movie. I do really like the rest of the movie a lot, but I think this first half an hour to an hour of just these characters discovering it and it being raw and happening right now was the best part of the movie.
I definitely agree with you. I think that like this part really moves along in terms of pacing.
So fast.
Something that I think is, but something that I think is really interesting is that like in most movies like this and where there's a serial killer, you start with the cops. You don't start with the press like figuring this out. And I think that it's a really interesting angle to start with, you know, obviously it's based off of Robert Graysmith's book, so sure, they're going to start with him, but I think it is still a really interesting angle to go from the aspect of being like, oh yeah, we're not going to stop with like what the cops are doing, because ACAB, and also they were completely incompetent, which is another thing that we'll talk about maybe on this podcast, maybe on the Zodiac podcast on Twisted Mug Mysteries, but just the police in a lot of like these early like serial killers in the US are just completely fucking incompetent with like a lot of the information that they've been given, and some of those people were eventually caught, but some of them, like the Zodiac killer, will remain unsolved.
I have a quick few quick points. One, it's interesting to hear you say that because one of his later projects, obviously David Fincher's later projects, is Mindhunter, which was
exactly,
you know, is all focused around that. But also,
is David Fincher okay?
Yeah, which I feel like we will mention that at least in passing at the start of an episode. But
it's
real
brilliant.
Quick, one other thing before you go, Matt. You had mentioned All the President's Men, Matt, and I think that this is an interesting film comparing those two movies, because if you think about it, it's almost like this movie in this case is like if Bernstein and Woodward didn't actually catch Nixon, I almost said Reagan, if they didn't actually catch Nixon and one of them went insane and just like went off the deep end, exactly, All the President's Men book held up by Matt there, audio medium. It's like if one of them went like completely like just lost it, became an alcoholic and died unfortunately young, and then the other one just obsessively wrote a book about it and never actually had conclusive proof. So it does feel very similar, like you said, Matt, to All the President's Men. And yeah, it's like, but this time they didn't get them. They just didn't get it.
It's it. Yes, I completely agree. All the President's Men, I would love to talk about that in CTP one day. I love the attention to detail in the movie, and just like this movie, a lot of All the President's Men is knocking on doors and interviewing people and picking up details and threads that then lose and that then lead you to dead ends that then you have to retrace and you find this. And I love that about this movie. Also about what Brendan said. I do like how this movie, you know, does also, you know, after that initial killing, we see Jake Gyllenhaal with his son and we get introduced to his character. But by and large, I think that the first, I guess, 45 minutes to an hour really feels like the Zodiac period of this movie. I mean, that's where all the killings are condensed. You know, because after the killing with the woman and the baby, I believe that's the last one we see. And
that wasn't even a killing. He didn't kill them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, actually, no, you're right. So yeah. The attempted murder,
mm-hmm.
The crime scene there. And after that, they don't show any more of Zodiac killings or Zodiac attempted killings, which I think is interesting because they kind of get that out of the way, whereas I think maybe a different movie would have spiced it out throughout the entire film. But then the majority of the movie focuses on these characters and the obsession, because that's what the movie's really about. You know what I mean? It's about them obsessing over Zodiac and how far and how deep down obsession can get you, which I really, really like. I like how they framework the movie like that.
Yeah, from this opening scene, I just instantly loved the entire vibe of this movie. When we get the all the fireworks and that, what is I'm blanking on the name of the song, but it's from Hair, and then later when we're in the city, we see like a big billboard for Hair, which I think is funny. And then
I didn't even pick up on that. Oh my god!
Yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah. And then just this parking lot like murder. I don't know. I guess this is a good time to talk about the music. I like it. But it often felt to me more like it's like a soundtrack than a score, if that makes sense. There are a lot of, you know, sometimes there's like a piece of music and it's applied to a sequence and it's a really cool sequence and the music is really well applied. But like when we first see Jake Gyllenhaal at work and there's like a what is it, one of those trash like bins? Or whatever it is, I don't know, and someone's bringing it. I'm totally blanking on what it's called, like the big rectangular thing that someone's wheeling around. And there's like this frantic jazz organ music. And it's really cool. But it's not like, you know, you don't get
right after the first murder is what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, then, I know what you're talking about.
Cool. Right, when when we first see him in the office during that whole sequence. And it's, you know, it's not like it's a theme or it's like a leitmotif that's going to come back later like you get in some other scores, but it is, you know, I do think it's really well done. I think it's just well applied to this scene that he's like, yep, this sequence is going to have this really cool music. And the song that plays, like, a lot of music plays, like, during some murders. And, yeah, so I think it's really well done. It's an unconventional score, but I like it.
Yeah, so the song you were talking about there, that's Soul Sacrifice by Santana. So that's not it's not composed by David Shire for this movie. A lot of the music for this movie is, you know, just taken from the 70s. We get the Hurdy-Gurdy Man by Donovan, I believe it is. And then we get What's Happening, Brother by Marvin Gaye. We get the Hair song. We get this. So a lot of the music in this movie, you know, is music from the 70s, which I really like. But in addition to that, the David Shire score, I want to talk about this for a bit. I think the David Shire score is fantastic. Gray Smith's theme specifically is the piano piece that plays at certain parts, which I really, really dug. And I love that they chose David Shire for the composer for this movie, because David Shire, if you know anything about him, was a prolific 70s film composer. He did the score for The Conversation, which is a brilliant movie that I would love to talk about here sometime, all about sound editing. And he was originally the composer for Apocalypse Now, but Francis Ford Coppola didn't like the soundtrack for it, so he scrapped it. But it's really interesting because it's a completely synth score. It's on YouTube because they released it recently. It's really interesting, adds a, you know, totally different layer to it. And he also contributed a bunch of songs to the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, most notably Disco Mountain, which is a bopping song. But I love that they have him for this movie because it totally grounded in that 70s vibe, which I love.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that part of the reason that I enjoyed the way that the soundtrack felt was that this, and it also ties back into a point that I was going to make earlier, but it slipped my mind. Is that this is a true story. And because it is so closely written to the true story of what actually happened, you know, if this was just like a completely fictitious story, I might be like, why are they using this like in these like weird places? Like, why do the characters seemingly have like no real ending in some places? But I think the fact that like, oh no, this is a true story, and like the endings for the characters are that they continue to live their lives because we know that happened. You can read what happened. I don't know. I think that that's part of the reason that it works for me, is that because I was able to keep in mind that, no, this is an adaptation of a real case that actually occurred in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think that, especially with a character played by Robert Downey Jr., which my brain is not doing good with names today.
Paul Avery.
Avery. I was going to say Alan, and I'm like, I don't think that's right. With Avery, like, he just drops off the film. He just, like, because he kind of, like, lost it a little bit and just disappeared. And then, I mean, this is basically a Graysmith story. So he was gone. You know, we get that one scene with him meeting Graysmith again, that one little shot in the bar of him drinking with, obviously, you know, telling him that he had emphysema or whatever. But besides that, you know, we just don't get much Robert Downey Jr. after that. And I think that in some ways, this movie, because it's so accurate to reality, it feels real. And one of the biggest things that I love about this movie, beyond like the pacing and Fincher's direction and style, is the production design. I feel like I talk about that a lot on this podcast. But one of the things that really grabbed me here is the production design. This movie feels like it's like in the 1960s and 1970s. Like, sometimes movies won't absolutely nail the aesthetic of that time, and they'll just go for like the obvious like goofy outfits of the time. But here, and I think another one that really does it well for this time period, it came out last year, was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. These two movies really know how to do this subtly. It's not like, oh, I'm going to get, you know, a bright orange ascot around one of my character's neck. It's like, no, it's going to be much subtler than that. And it's really well done here.
And the way that they adapt the fashion to you know, show you the as time passes, right? You know, because first we see the Mark Ruffalo character, and, you know, in his cop gear, and later on in the 70s we see him wearing this kind of turtleneck. Oh, I think it's so good. And the movie never feels, the aesthetic never feels like a pastiche. You know, it feels real. It feels very grounded in the world. I think it's very, very well done. And I love, you know, and visually I think this movie really conveys the passage of time well. You know, along with the soundtrack, along with the characters' outfits. You know, we even get the one shot of the Transamerica building, you know, being constructed as time goes on, which I think is a really smart and visually interesting way to do that to us without just, you know, telling us, you know, what year it is. Even though there are, you know, title cards kind of telling you what year it is, but
yeah, there's a ton of those, and there's a lot of time jumps in this movie, as it
there are
needs to have. But I think one of the things that I really want to talk about is the way that Fincher constructs these murder scenes, because we haven't really talked about the nitty gritty of these murder scenes yet. The first one is absolutely terrifying. You know, because everyone knows a Zodiac killer. Everyone knows that this is a movie about a serial killer. So you know that these aren't your main characters, especially in the opening scene. And you know that they're going to die. When they go to the restaurant and the woman's like, we should go somewhere quiet, everyone is screaming at the screen like, no, do not do that. Just sit there, eat a burger, and go home.
It's such a cliche. Like, these two, like, teenagers in the 60s story, are, like, so going to a parking lot to neck, and then they get killed. But, like,
I mean, it's not a teenager.
Well, okay.
Whatever. It's an older woman.
It's very much
cheating on her husband.
It's very much the vibe, though.
But the thing is, this is a true story.
What?
It's a true story, so it's not a cliche.
Well, yeah, right. But, I mean, It is still a cliche, even though it was a real event. It is still. But no, what I was going to say is that Fincher makes it seem not like a cliche. Like, for whatever reason, his style makes it feel fresh. It's not like, Jesus, I've seen this 70 times before in every horror movie ever. Like, it feels like something new, which I think is very good, because it would have been very easy for him to say, just because it is, you know, just because it was a real event that happened, for him to say, like, yeah, I can't really do anything about this. I just kind of have to make it seem like all of these other scenes, because this is what happened. But he actually does something cool with it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
Absolutely. And I love the way that Fincher plays with having the Zodiac Killer on screen. Mm-hmm. Because even when characters see him, we don't get to see him. Yeah. And I think that's very smart. And there's ways, like, we see the body of the actor a lot, in this movie, and actually I think they had three different actors play the Zodiac Killer at different points in this movie. There's literally Zodiac 1, 2, 3, and 4.
We also
Zodiac
see,
1 and 2 was Richard Arquette.
We also see a very clear hairline on one of them, which is kind of an issue. When he's getting out of the taxi, we see like a receding hairline with a very pronounced widow's peak. And I'm like, okay, so the killer's got to have that, right? And then the guy that we're supposed to be maybe thinking is the killer is like entirely bald on the top of the head. I don't know.
Well, time has passed. I don't know. It was a while before they actually tracked down Arthur Lee Allen.
Sure, yeah.
It's true. I mean, yeah, I'm not too... I think there is a... Even if that is the case and you were thinking like, oh, I should be looking for this, I think that's the point.
Yes.
I think Fincher is like, this is an unsolved case. Richard Graysmith, Robert Graysmith thinks, again, not doing good with names today. Robert Graysmith thinks that it's Arthur Lee Allen, but it's not proven. The dude died. It lines up. Like, if you take the last scene as gospel with him in Mark Ruffalo, it lines up. It makes sense. But then there's also things that don't make sense, like the
evidence.
Prints in the handwriting. Yeah, the evidence. Nothing like, timeline, it makes sense, but the evidence doesn't make sense. So I think by having those little details, I don't think that was an accident by Fincher. I think Fincher did all these things to show that we don't know who did this.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, and he also, like, even in this opening scene, right, when the girl goes to the diner, and then she's like, oh, I have to leave the diner, and she kind of seems frantic about it, and it almost, like, it seems like he's hinting, and then he says, oh, was that car back at the diner? And I like he kind of plants these seeds of suspicion where he's not saying, like, oh, she knew the guy, she saw him at the diner, and she had to leave. But I love how he kind of, like, plants these little ideas that, like, make you think a little bit more about it. It's like, oh, did she know him? She saw his car at the diner and then left, which I think is so interesting.
Yeah, no, it's like we were talking about with Panic Room. He doesn't always need to spell out every little thing for us. Sometimes he can just have it be more subtle. He can plant those seeds, he can sow them later, well, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I think it, in terms of his, like, appearance and stuff like that, I think that in this movie there are a lot of, like, misleading factors. Because when you look back at, like, the descriptions of the Zodiac that were given in the actual case files, it's always that he's, like, late 20s, early 30-year-old man, aging up from the points that he made the murders. He is, like, stocky. He has brownish-red hair, a little bit curly or in a crew cut. Like, but they didn't go... I think it's better that they didn't get an actor that, like, we just saw the back of their head that looked exactly like that. I think it is... I think it plays better to, you know, the confusion of the case and the confusion at the time of the murders, by having this sort of this killer that we don't know really anything about and is constantly, like, changing every time we see
him. Because the description was always changing of him. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing was ever consistent. And I think that Fincher is not doing this by accident. Fincher is a very meticulous filmmaker. This dude does not do things by accident. Like, Fincher is very specific about what he wants on his film sets. And, like, so I can't imagine, you know, that these hairline things were a mistake. I think all of these appearances, and especially having three different actors play the Zodiac Killer in these scenes, like, was intentional. Fincher saying, this is what, you know, this is how I have to portray this.
Well, and it's a very small thing to be fixating on here for, you know, more than, like, 30 seconds. But
sure, but I think it shows that Fincher has an insane attention to detail.
Yes, but, you know, the hairline, why it's weird for me is that it's something that we're seeing that nobody else is seeing, right? That's something that is just meant to confuse us and doesn't confuse anyone else in the context of the story. It's just meant to show us this is the person's hairline. And then we see later that the prime suspect, who I feel like we're supposed to believe it is, but, you know, again, maybe he's not, but, like, I feel like we can, if Fincher really is being that meticulous, I think we can rule out Lee.
I like how they do that, because it feels like when we see that shot of the cabbie in the hairline that we're talking about, that's from the window of the person who called the police. So it feels like a very subjective point of view. And even there is inconsistencies in the police report that go out. At first they say it's a black male, and then it's a Caucasian. So I think that totally plays into the confusion of that event. And even the person who was calling it in said, oh, there's this guy, and she gives a pretty, like, inaccurate description about him. So everything in that scene feels very subjective and very cluttered, which, I mean, we can move on from the hairline thing, but that's how I feel about that.
That's right. Yeah. Well, okay, there's another tiny detail later that when we get to it, I'll point it out, because if Fincher really is being this meticulous, then I'm curious to know your interpretation.
Okay.
Maybe he just couldn't hire one actor for the whole time, and he just had to use three.
I really don't think that's the case.
Doubt
I think
it
that's
as
absolutely
well,
intentional.
It's possible.
Yeah, it is. So we get an introduction to Mark Ruffalo's Detective Tashi, who I just saw on IMDb trivia. Do you guys know the backstory of Tashi, or the little side note about Tashi?
Like Tosky? The in real life with Stephen
yeah,
Queen?
With George Lucas.
Oh, no, I don't. Explain.
This, because of everything that happens later with the letter and stuff, George Lucas felt that he was unfairly treated in the press and named Tashi Station to pick up some power converters
in episode four
after this detective.
But they pronounce it differently.
Yeah, I know, but yeah. That's what George Lucas said he named it after.
Unfairly treated by the... Wait, what did you mean?
I don't know. It says somewhere in this IMDb trivia that he felt that he was unfairly treated in the press or whatever, and he felt bad for him, and he felt that he was doing a good job. If you go to IMDb trivia, it's there.
Oh, I see. So he respected him, and he named the power station after him. Okay, I had no idea. That's interesting.
So pick up some power converters for Ruffalo.
Yeah, the bit of trivia I was going to bring up where they kind of hint at in the movie was, I didn't realize, but Dave Tosh was actually, you know, pretty famous in that time because Steve McQueen studied him while he was preparing for his role in Bullet. And that's why they mentioned, oh, he wears his gun like Bullet, because Bullet emulated how he wears his gun. Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, he's not like just a cop who, you know, is trying to be this, you know, braggadocious guy who imitates these movie cops. It's like, no, they were literally imitating him. And I think he plays it very well. He plays it similarly, you know, I'll bring an Alien reference in here, to Tom Skerritt playing Dallas in Alien. And kind of this guy who's a little bit tired, you know, he believes in the book, he's going to play by the book. You know, he just feels very weary at times. But he also has a real passion for the case, which I like.
One other Alien thing that I noticed in this movie was the score, the main theme, didn't it kind of, with the horn, kind of remind you of the horn theme from Alien?
I can kind of see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, anytime I heard the up and down of the horn, it reminded me of the Alien theme. Maybe it's just because we watched that so recently, but, and also because of the Fincher tie to the series, but I can't imagine Fincher wanting to put any reference to Alien intentionally into his movies at this point.
True.
Please let me
But
forget.
No, yes. I did want to talk about real quick, because we haven't talked about each individual performance. I do want to knock these three out. RDJ, right before Iron Man. Jake Gyllenhaal, still kind of coming off this weird point in his career where Hollywood wanted him to be, you know, this just heartthrob, but...
And
I think
weird, and I love it.
He's a weird man,
I love him so much.
This movie shows it, and I feel like Donnie Darko, like, he blew up with Donnie Darko, and that was him, like, this is who I am, and then they're like, you're hot, so you should be in teen heartthrob movies, and then he was like, no, I want to be crazy people, because that's what I like to play. But also, I do want to point out, before we talk about those other two, Ruffalo is also fantastic in this movie.
Yeah,
I think all of the performances are really awesome. I just wanted to, side note, bring up, there are some videos of Jake Gyllenhaal in Sunday in the Park with George, which is my favorite musical. But he, definitely, if you want to see like the full extent of how crazy this man is, watch him sing the dog song, in which he pretends to be two different dogs. I love the dog song, because it's just George going back and forth, like pretending to be two different dogs at once and doing different voices while like crawling around the stage on all fours. And to watch Jake Gyllenhaal do that just brings me so much joy.
I love Jake Gyllenhaal.
I did not know that.
I'll send you the video later. It's great. I have it saved.
Wasn't Gyllenhaal supposed to be Spider-Man at some point? Wasn't he one of the main people up for Spider-Man in 2002?
That would have been wacky.
I think he was. I'm going to look this up while you guys talk about the performances. I'll let you know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I had just rewatched Nightcrawler, which Floyd, I know you've seen, but it's Jake Gyllenhaal stars in, and he plays a complete psychopath, a complete fucking weirdo. And I was just struck by this man's range. You know what I mean? That he plays, you know, also, you know, a bit of an off kilter character in this movie, but then just, you know, to be able to play such a absolute whack job in Nightcrawler, and then back to here, then in Brokeback Mountain, like, he is just a fantastic, and in Wildlife, and in Okja.
I was gonna say Wildlife, completely different performance.
Just and in Okja, absolutely bonkers. Oh, he's an amazing, amazing actor. And he brings that, you know, that perfect boyish charm to this. They describe him as a Boy Scout so many times. There's some great banter in the newsroom with RDJ where, you know, he says that he's looming again. He has to leave. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, no, he's fantastic. And by the way, I just found out Tobey Maguire got injured in Spider-Man 2, and they talked about recasting him with Jake Gyllenhaal. Wow. So they decided to wait and finish the movie with Maguire.
It's a damn shame.
But no, yeah, I love Gyllenhaal in this movie. Yeah, like you said, him and RDJ have really good chemistry together. Even though I feel like we don't get much character work, I'd say, in the first hour of the movie, because everything is just focused on the killings and like kind of the craze around it. And I don't see that as a problem with the movie.
I think it articulates.
We just get these little character ticks. Yeah, no, they absolutely do, and that's why I said that this is my favorite part of the movie. But I feel like the little ticks is all you need. Like RDJ saying, "What did we talk about? The L word," and it's these implied interactions that we had, but like that these scenes that we could have had before, but they would have killed the pacing.
Yeah.
So I think that even just having these actors do these deliveries very well and having really good chemistry gives you the sense that over this time that has passed, these characters have interacted a lot and have become friends.
Does Avery at one point when they're in the bar just like subtly do coke and then never talk about it?
Yeah, I love that. He just puts
something up his nose and then like wipes it off in the next shot. And like, I was like, what is going on here?
And I love the way that they hint at it. They never mention that he's doing cocaine, because later on when he's completely gone, you know, he's gone kind of crazy. The editor is like, stop doing whatever you're doing, and kind of like winks at him like, I know what you're doing. I'm not going to say you're doing cocaine, but you're doing it. And I love that. And I mean, that's like very accurate to what a 70s newsroom was. Like, not necessarily that you could do cocaine in the newsroom, but that everyone was
just
drinking,
pull it out and rip
smoking
a line.
And smoking. Like, that's just like the atmosphere. That's how it was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like I said, everything about this feels period accurate, because, you know, I was there in the 70s. I know what it was like.
You know,
Yeah, I know exactly what it was like. I'll just say it feels authentic.
Yeah, and I'm saying that also because in Roger Ebert's review of this movie, and Roger Ebert was a reporter in the 70s for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he was like, this feels so accurate. Like, this is what we did. We went to bars in the middle of the day and talked about our cases.
Cool. Very cool. Yeah, I didn't know that. But yeah, so is there anything else from these murder scenes or attempted murder scenes that you guys want to talk about that really stuck out to you? I do love the way that they play with the flashlight in that opening scene and those kind of things.
I also wanted to talk about the lake scene. I love the lake scene.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Brutal.
It's so interesting. Like, okay, first of all, the way that Fincher uses silence in this scene is really cool. You just hear like these ambient nature sounds while this like horrific stabbing is happening, but also the killer's motivations in this scene are so strange. Like, he threatens them with a gun to get his wallet and keys. He has the woman tie up the man, then he ties up the woman, then he reties the man because it wasn't tight enough, then he acts like he's not gonna shoot them, and then he doesn't shoot them, and then he stabs them. But then did he just want their wallet and keys? Like, why did he need the wallet and keys if he was just gonna
trophies?
I don't think he did,
because like I don't know, because he says that he wants like slaves for the afterlife or something, which is why he's killing
he's
them
crazy.
So we know that he's gonna kill them, and he doesn't just want their wallet and keys, but then he gets them. Why? I don't know.
I take it as trophies.
I get the sense that he like doesn't quite know what he's doing, and he's sort of figuring it out as he goes along, which is interesting because he seems like such a meticulous killer. He's writing out these ciphers, he's sending these letters. I mean, then again, maybe this wasn't actually the Zodiac, you know, maybe this was just someone imitating the Zodiac or just a random serial killer. But it does kind of seem like, you know, once he tells them to get down, then he's like, okay, I guess I should tie them up. And now that they're down, I guess I can stab them, so I'll do that now. It kind of seems like he's working it in his head. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I did think maybe at first, like, maybe this is not the real Zodiac. Maybe he's like a copycat that's like riding the coattails of this other person. But since he, you know, his motivations were to get a wallet and keys, which seemed pretty, you know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's a pretty surfacey reason to mug someone, basically. But yeah, no, I was wondering if maybe the movie was going to go for like a Joker type thing where like, it's not one guy. It's like about the movement. Spoilers for Joker, I guess, kind of, but, but yeah, no, it's, and you know, maybe that is, part of the movie in the end. Like, maybe all of these weren't the same person. Hence why we had four different actors, you know? So I think that's kind of interesting.
I think it's definitely, that's one theory, is that the Zodiac was multiple people either working independently or working together, which obviously we get the scene later on, which we'll talk about, where he goes to visit the other suspect, whose name I'm blanking on right now, and then he's like, oh, I drew the posters. And so there's a theory that those two were working together and killing people as the Zodiac killer.
And that guy's creepy.
That guy is creepy as fuck.
Yeah, I want to talk about that scene when we get there, though.
Yeah, but I was going to say something that Matt brought up, I think that's really interesting, is that I think that, like, there is something, like, very erratic about the way that the Zodiac acts in this scene. And I think it's, you know, there's times when, like, they talk about him, like, possibly having some kind of mental illness that, like, alters his mental state when he, like, is killing people. So, I don't know, obviously, the Zodiac killer in real life didn't see Fight Club and didn't see the narrator turn into Tyler Durden, but maybe we could be dealing with something similar. There was also, like, I just think it's interesting that he does seem so, like, meticulous in some moments, but then in other moments he's acting, like, completely erratic and, like, he doesn't really know what he's doing. Because especially the fact that, like, in the wallet, the report that the guy that, fuck, I'm blanking on his name, was actually stabbed then, he only had 85 cents in his pocket. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't have, like, any money on him, and he was like, I could write you a check or something like that. So, like, I don't think that, like, money was the motivation at all in this case. I think it was just, like, him kind of figuring out, like, how do I set the scene for this? How do I make it seem like, you know, I'm not, like, I maybe it was a shock factor or something like that. I don't really know. And I guess we'll probably never know. But it's interesting to see the difference in the two behaviors of the Zodiac in certain times.
Yeah, I saw that as, I did see it as him taking trophies, but also at the same time, like you said, Brenna, it could be him just wanting to set up initially, just be like, give a pretense for, like, oh, these are people were being robbed. But then, no, he killed them, or at least killed one of them. This brings me to one question I have. Maybe, Brendan, you can answer this because you did a little research. Who is Jimmy Simpson playing at the end of the movie? The person that that gets interviewed at the end, he IDs,
sure,
Lee. Is it this guy right here at the lake,
no,
or is it a different?
It's the first one.
It's the first guy.
It's the first
that
one.
Gets
okay.
Shot in the throat, like in the beginning, that we see right when they're in the lover's lane, and it's the first guy that we see get shot.
Okay.
Yeah. Just older.
Yeah, that's fair, Floyd, because I think only upon this viewing did I realize it was the first kid and not the lake boy. Something I want to touch on in this scene is the subtle characterization that goes on, which I think this entire movie is very subtle in implying, you know, when these events are taking place and with whom and the characterization. I love how here it's very small, but we get these lines from the man here, from the couple, where he's like, you know, I might be able to help you out. He starts acting kind of cocky, you know, when the guy is pointing the gun at him. Mm-hmm. And he says this line where the lady says a line about him. She says he's a sociology major. And he says, pre-law, actually. And it's like a strange line where it's like adds some sort of levity to the scene. But it's also sad because you see that they, like, really think that this is going to be over soon. And then when he's tying him up, like, he gets kind of arrogant with it. And he's like, are you done yet? Can you let us go? And then I think that's so great. And how I think it makes then the shot of him bloody and in the car, like, quivering even more horrific. Knowing that, you know, he didn't even think it was going to be this intense.
Yeah, something that's actually kind of interesting about that is I was watching, I was reading a transcript of an interview with the guy that you're talking about, the law student, whose name I cannot remember for the life of me.
Names are hard today.
Names are hard today. I don't know why. Maybe because they're all real people.
The same thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because he talks about how in the moments before he was stabbed, he was kind of thinking like, how am I gonna, like, he's like, all right, how, like, after this, how are we gonna get untied? Like, how am I gonna, like, what am I gonna do if he, like, starts coming near us? And then he, like, got stabbed before, like, in the context of it, the way that I read the transcripts from this dude's, like, the real life guy, that is, his actual interview, was that he felt like, I'm not really in any danger right now. Like, this is just some dude that, like, wants money or something. It's going to be whatever. And then he got stabbed and then watched his lover, girlfriend, I don't know, get stabbed to death.
Yeah, and to get back to the movie, because I do want to save some of that kind of discussion for the Twisted Mug Mystery. Yeah, I do kind of want to try to, since we're doing two podcasts on this topic, I do kind of want to stay to the movie. I think what works really well with that, then, knowing that that was how he actually felt, Fincher relays that very well, yeah. Like the way Matt was describing. Like, Fincher relays very well that this guy did not think he was in that much danger, because he even says at one point, were there even really bullets in the gun? Because he didn't think he was actually going to get hurt. He thought he was just going to take his wallet and leave.
A great shot, yeah.
Yeah, and he pulls the bullets out, and then, again, it's really fucked up, because then he shows him the bullets. You think, okay, the audience is thinking, he's like, okay, he's going to get shot now, and then he all of a sudden he just pulls out a knife and starts stabbing these people.
Terrific.
And that's what I'm saying with, like, Fincher, so many times in these movies, with either even in Alien 3 that I, you know, I don't like Alien 3, but even in Alien 3 and Fight Club especially, and in 7 especially, he does not shy away from showing very horrific things on screen. And again, we'll get to this later with, like, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. There's some horrific scenes in that movie. And especially, he doesn't shy away from showing things that really happened in this movie in a very brutal way. Like, we watch actual, like, recreations of real murders, which I think why this movie works for me more as a horror movie than I mean, it's a great thriller, but I feel like, for me, this movie is in the horror category for me. Horror movies are scary. Like, Hereditary, scary movie. I like that movie. Not as much, you know, since Midsummer, but I still really like it. Side point. Those those movies are scary, right? Those are scary movies. But for me, it's always scarier when you're seeing something that really happened. When you're seeing things that actually occurred, it's always scarier. And I think that's why these scenes are so effective, and why I just keep having us come back to them, is because it's what really sticks out in my mind from these movies, is because we are watching recreations of actual murders. And I'm assuming, again, because of the historical accuracy that Brendan is saying, that this is probably exactly how it happened.
This is this is also going back to, like, real life, but it does tie into the movie, which I think is interesting. So both of the survivors were kind of asked when this movie was coming out, like, hey, like, what do you think about them, like, recreating this? And at, like, the first time that they were both asked, they were like, why the fuck would I want a movie made about that experience? Like, I don't want to think about that part of my life anymore. But then the second guy, the one that we were just talking about, I think...
Jimmy Simpson's character, I'm assuming?
Yeah. Was eventually like, yeah, okay, like, I understand that David Fincher is going to do this, like, and he's going to do it factually. He's not going to embellish it for Hollywood or anything like that, which I thought was interesting.
And take the sting out of it by not showing these scenes, yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, and again, and I think that's what makes it so effective, is that Fincher doesn't shy away from doing these things. This is why I respect this movie and him as a director so much, is because he, even when I don't like his movies, he, like with The Game and Alien 3, he doesn't shy away from things. Like, he will go there. He, even if it doesn't work, he will go there and then learn from it going forward.
That's why I was really worried in the sequence with the mother and her baby. I was like... I was so nervous.
He knew where to draw the line.
I was like, what are you going to show me here? Like, what are you, like, don't show me this. And then, because I didn't know the story, I didn't know that, like, she survives. And so,
But that's such a great scene.
It's still a super effective scene, yeah.
It's so great because we have just come from the lake scene where we saw this horrific act of violence, and we are expecting yet another act of violence to occur, and it doesn't happen. So when we get, you know, that car leading up, when we see her screaming in the road, we are expecting the worst. We are expecting horrific imagery, but we don't get it. And somehow that is scarier. Somehow, like, that, like, almost brings me to tears. When she won't communicate with the truck driver, but then when the other woman drives up and she's able to kind of relate to her, and she runs and picks up that baby because she literally, like, had to hide it because she was afraid that he was going to come back. That is so terrifying.
I don't know about you guys, but I think this also plays into the fact that, you know, this movie is Grace Smith's perspective, but it also does play with the idea that maybe it's more than one person, and that this was just one person who did one murder and then started taking credit for other things. Which I think is one of the scary things about this case.
It's a curious case.
Curious case of Benjamin Button.
Curious case of Ted Cruz.
And I think, again, with the different actors playing the murder, I think that this is just... These are choices made by Fincher that I think shows how great of a hold on this material that he had. None of these feel the same, and this one feels so scary because it is... This is the most thought out one.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, because if he just shows up at a lover's lane and kills a couple people, he shoots a cabbie driver just who's driving him around. Here, he gets someone to stop, pretends like he's fixing their tire, slashes their tire, has them pull over, abducts the woman and her child, and then we cut. And that's where, like, I feel like these are the different, like, layers of the Zodiac Killer, the Zodiac case, or whatever Zodiac actually is, that I think it's what it shows us and makes us feel the same way about the case and the killer that RDJ, Gyllenhaal, and Ruffalo eventually feel, and it connects you to those characters. Like I said, it's not that this movie gives you a lot of time with these characters in terms of, oh, this is their backstory, this is, you know, who they are as a person, you know, all that stuff, maybe besides Graysmith. But it's having this shared experience with the characters and feeling the same helplessness of them as them, which really connects us to the characters in the movie.
I think this scene is so interesting, especially with this story also of Kathleen Johns, I believe her name is, because it is one of the, like, this is the person that has had ostensibly the most face time with the Zodiac Killer. And so, like, I know...
Did they ever ID, like, have her ID,
Lee Allen? I'm not entirely sure. Because, I mean, I think she tried to, like, ID some, like, people or, like, give, like, a description. But I think what they said was, like, they weren't really listening to her because... I don't remember why, but, like, they, like, kind of just tossed it out and were like, ah, whatever.
It's disappointing.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think that some people also thought, in real life, that is, that this was, like, an unconfirmed, like, meeting because they were like, well, this, like, it doesn't fit.
They didn't die.
She didn't die. It doesn't fit the other things. Like, maybe she was just making it up. But then also that note came out, the other letter from the Zodiac that was like, I'm going to kill that mother and the baby that I gave an interesting ride to. So I don't know. It's a really interesting scene because she is technically the only, besides the first dude that gets shot, but he doesn't have like a full conversation with him. And also something that's really creepy is that the dialogue in this scene is like the exact words that he said to her when, she was in his car.
And exactly, that's my point, that Fincher doesn't shy away from this stuff. And that's what makes this movie so scary. Hearing you say that makes that scene even scarier.
Especially that line where he just says, oh, I didn't know you had a baby. Ooh.
Yeah. Terrifying. So to move away from some of the murders the way the movie does, what I think propels us into the second half of the movie that I really, really enjoy is focusing on then the mental effects on everyone else throughout the years. And I think of the three characters, it's obvious I think that Mark Ruffalo probably takes it the best. Not to say that he doesn't take it terribly, but the best of the three. And I do like how we see these little clues just from what happened between those times. Like, you know, we see the date with Jake Gyllenhaal and his future wife, and then all of a sudden, just a few years later, like 20 minutes later on screen time, they're just living together, they're married, and they have kids. Like, yeah. they don't feel that, again, Fincher not feeling the need to explain little things like that, which is fantastic. And I love this section. Again, this isn't my favorite section of the movie, but I still love it. As we slowly go down the rabbit hole now, because like the beginning of the movie is just the murders and it's the hysteria around it, and then once it stops, it's just like you feel like you are just going down that slope with them, and eventually RDJ just completely falls out of the movie.
Yeah, and we were talking about with Jake Gyllenhaal and his marriage and the date and how it kind of flows seamlessly from date to marriage. It's the date that never ended. You know, that's the line that she says. She says, you know, you don't want to admit it, but it is the date that never ended. You never stopped obsessing. And, and I never stopped to realize how destructive this was to our family, which I think is a really great way to represent that within the story.
Yeah,
but within the movie, too, that what's so great about that scene is that she gives him the last piece that he feels that he needed to put everything together.
Yep, she's like, do whatever you have to do, but finish this. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it seems like he never did because he wrote two books about it. You know, he didn't stop after the first book. No. And yeah, let's talk about Robert Downey Jr.'s character a little bit, because of the last hour and a half of the movie does, like, you know, it leaves him. So let's talk about him a little bit. I feel bad for him. Again, Robert Downey Jr. is playing typical Robert Downey Jr., I think.
Tony Stark, yeah.
Yeah, he's playing Tony Stark, except he's not a superhero and he's not super rich. He's just
Before Tony Stark.
Yeah. But I'm saying, like, he has that same Robert Downey Jr. persona that he has and everything. But I think what really works here is that in these time gaps, you can see the destructiveness of what that personality or that lifestyle would actually have on someone, unlike Tony Stark. Like, like when you start to see like the crow's feet really set in, you start to see the beard start to gray, and you can just feel that like he's drunk at 9:30 in the morning. Especially that scene where he's then asked Jake Gyllenhaal to go to the bar with him. It's like, that's just sad. Like it gets to the point where I feel bad for Jake Gyllenhaal's character by the end, because he's so obsessed with it that it ruins his life in like a manic way. But here it just completely destroyed his psyche, like took his addiction and like put it to just the most destructive way. And then eventually we know, especially with the gas tank later, we know this is killing him.
Yeah.
It's like Mark Ruffalo's character says. He says, the Arthur Lee Allens of this world will suck you dry, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's Paul Avery is a really, really funny character. But I think the scene where reality, they kind of smack you over the head with reality, is when he goes to the boathouse. And it's not, he's got charm to him, but it's faded, you know? It's not, it's sad, you know? He's living in this decrepit house. He's working at this newspaper that's, like, you know, significantly less prestigious than the other one. I mean,
he just has Pong just playing on his TV.
Yeah. It's sad. And he has lost all his vigor for the case. He's like, look, I don't care anymore. Like, we never even got anywhere. Why are you still interested? And then, so kind of in a weird way, that provides more motivation for Jake Gyllenhaal. Like, all right, I'll do it by myself, which I think is really great. But yeah, I think the banter with these two and the other newsroom people, oh God, it's always so fantastic. Funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's an amazing actor.
Do you guys have anything to add about RDJ in this movie?
Not especially. He's very good.
Yeah.
So I say we move on to, you know, the real focus of the last hour and a half of this movie really shifts from the killers to Graysmith. And as we've said before, Jake Gyllenhaal is fantastic. What I love about this movie is it takes the cartoonist, it takes Gyllenhaal, and he's just this, you know, they say many times, this boy scout, just cartoonist, just very meek, very mild, and throws you down the rabbit hole with him. And it feels like every time there's these little breaks in the case, that really energize him, it feels like a natural progression of the character. And I think that this is a very well-written character, because all of this feels very natural. And it feels like you are slipping with him. And the scene that I want to talk about late in the movie that really, I think, is probably the best scene in the movie, best individual scene in the movie, is when he goes to that dude's house, and he sees the drawings and all that stuff, and, you know, it relates the handwriting. At least the way I took it, I don't think this dude has any relation to the Zodiac Killer. I think this is the exact example of the trick that Fincher does in this movie. He makes you feel paranoid, like Jake Gyllenhaal does, that this guy is going to kill me, when this dude probably has nothing to do with this. This dude is probably just literally a projectionist that draws some fucking posters and just was nice enough to invite this person to his home and show him some canisters of films. He was getting sucked into these, like he has a basement, so he assumes that he's a murderer. Like and it conveys that to us. Like, Fincher is like, yes, you should be feeling this way too. And it shows you how crazy it is when you think about it. At the end, it's just like, yeah, this dude turns off a light as he's walking away from his basement. And again, it's portrayed to us the way that Graysmith has seen it, that this means that this man's going to come and kill you. And then he's like, oh, the door's locked. He's trying to trap me in and kill you. He's like, no, I just need to unlock the door, and then you can go. I love the way that this movie plays on the paranoia of the genre, but also on Graysmith. And this is what I mean by connection to characters. These kind of scenes where you feel exactly what Gyllenhaal is feeling because of Fincher's direction.
It's so unsubtle, but it completely works. I mean,
it's perfect.
It's the most obvious, like, hey, it's this guy. It's this guy right here. I'm playing the scary music. I'm having him go into the basement. I'm shooting it this way. And I'm like,
they have the, you know, the handwriting
right.
match.
Right. Like, Jake Gyllenhaal gets scared by the dude's reflection in the mirror. We get scared by the dude's reflection in the mirror. Like, yeah, it's absolutely really well done. And it's also, you know, it's the most obvious thing that Fincher could do as a director.
It's kind of cool, though, because Robert Graysmith, like, that actually happened to him. Was like, mm-hmm. he went to this, I mean, obviously, because it's a true story, but of the things that were embellished, he claims that when he was in the guy's house that he heard footsteps upstairs and was like, is there someone else in the house? And the guy was like, no. So there's also the possibility that he thinks that the two, like I said before, that they were working together and that he may have been in the home with the Zodiac Killer at the same time. But then again, that's just Robert Graysmith.
I'd be like,
Robert
Graysmith. Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. It could be. We have possible. No idea.
It's so brilliant. The moment, you know, that always stands out to me is, you know, when whoever this actor is, great actor, and he goes, Mr. Graysmith, I write the posters myself. And then you have a shot of Jake Gyllenhaal, like a close-up, but then you see the guy, like, out of focus in the background, and just him standing there is so ominous, and, like, suddenly a regular shot of this man, just by one line, just everything about this scene turns ominous. And it was eerie before, but now it is terrifying and life-threatening. It is so, so well executed. And just the idea of, there was a film canister that he told me never to open. You know what I mean? Like, that is such a terrifying idea. And it's so, like, it doesn't really follow, because we never see the Zodiac kill someone and then film it. Like, it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And I think
that's what I'm saying. I think Fincher is supposed to be telling us, like, I'm giving you all these visual clues of a normal horror movie to say this is the killer, but we all know that this is not the killer.
Completely. And I think maybe Jake Gyllenhaal or Robert Graysmith in the back of his head, you know, maybe knows that, but he's too deep in. He's too obsessed. We're too obsessed. We don't want to look away. We think he's a bad guy. It's so well done.
I just looked it up. That character's name is Bob Vaughn. Robert Graysmith later said that he was never a suspect in the case. Even though those things did happen to him.
That character is just wowee Bob.
Wowee Bob.
Oh wait, wowee Bob. That's the voice of Roger Rabbit. interesting. Yeah, Charles Fleischer. Interesting.
Good for him.
That played Bob Vaughn. How do you like that?
The last part of this movie, the last like 20 minutes of this movie, I think are fantastic beyond that scene. I love when
he was in Rango,
when we see that it's taken over Gyllenhaal's life so much that he's literally having his young kids like be his his crew, and it's so sad, like, just to see this man devolve that much to having his kids and to traumatizing his kids, probably like showing them all these this homicides and all this insane case. The oldest one there was 13, like max 13. Yeah. Like there was no way that they were older than like 9 to 13.
It's like the dude who wrote the script for 7 being like, hey kids, what do you think of this? Look at what I wrote.
Yeah, hey kids, should I show the decapitated head in the box or no? Like, what do you think?
And it's even more like fucked up and just wacky, because he's literally having them correlate the lunar cycle to when the killings took place. Like, he is so deep into this rabbit hole that like he is like these random like fringe conspiracy theories ideas, which is just absolutely bonkers. Although, you know, maybe if he examined the cycles of Jupiter and Saturn and their conjunction, maybe there might be a clue there as to when the killings will take place. All you Back in Style fans out there.
But I do also love once we get that scene with the wife and he finally gets that little last piece of evidence after everything for it to all come together to Lee Allen. I think what works about this movie, again, I love the scene of him going to wake up Tashi. I love the scene of them sitting there and eating, laying everything out. It's so fantastic. And in the movie by the end is like telling you, we think it's Allen. But what I really enjoy about it is, like, I don't think Fincher necessarily, like, Fincher might believe it's Allen. I don't know. What it feels like is it's saying, like, by the end of this, this was Graysmith's book that we're adapting. This is Graysmith's side. He thinks that it's Allen. So I think that it makes sense that the movie portrays that they think that it's Allen. And regardless of whatever we talk about on Twisted Mug Mysteries of who we actually think it is, if we think it's one person, if we think it's multiple, I don't know what that conversation is going to hold, Brendan. I think we should save it.
Definitely.
I think this movie does a good job of, by the end of it, feeling satisfying that it's at least a decent chance that it's Allen, even though we know we'll never prove it.
Completely. To spend a little bit of time on Ruffalo's character, because we kind of jump ahead in time.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about how, you know, this case really derails Avery. It really, really derails Jake Gyllenhaal's character. You know, he loses his marriage for a second time. This is his second marriage, you know?
And loses his kids, probably.
Yeah. With Mark Ruffalo's character, it's interesting because he never gets so obsessed in it that he, like, loses his family or something like that. But he gets screwed over by this. He gets completely screwed over, and it wasn't his fault. You know, he obviously was not the one writing the letters. He was not the Zodiac. But he gets completely screwed over, and I love how visually they convey this. When we jump forward 7 years or whatever, we just get a shot of the house. Okay, he's living in a condo now, and we immediately see, okay, they've totally downscaled. They don't have as much money. He's not dressing like he used to dress. He doesn't look like Bullet anymore. It's so, like, it's sad, and that's what I love about, like, his visual storytelling. And even before, when he immediately loses his job, and we cut to Graysmith, like, annoyingly calling his household, like, trying to talk to Mark Ruffalo after he's lost his job, and all we get is a shot of him in the back, kind of, like, in a bathrobe with a wine glass, with jazz music, like, walking around. Like, that's all we need to know that, like, wow, this man is distraught, he lost his job. And then even later, when we see him walking out of some sort of building, and, you know, and Graysmith once again is trying to interrogate him, trying to get more clues. He's walking, and the sign behind him says traffic courts, and it points from where he came. Like, this man is not on homicide anymore. He's working the low-level, like, beats that the regular cops do, and it's demeaning to him. You know what I mean? And it's so well conveyed.
Yeah, I love it. I think that the way they handle Ruffalo's character, even though he is definitely the third main character, I would say, of the three characters. I think that, again, I mean, the tagline of this movie is basically, I'm paraphrasing, it's like, there's more than one way to lose your life to a killer.
Yeah.
And I think we see all of that. I mean, we obviously see the murders, and then we see Avery go down just a rabbit hole of addiction. We see Gyllenhaal's character go down a rabbit hole of obsession. And then we see Ruffalo's character just get career-wise destroyed by this investigation and everything that comes around, the paranoia around it. And I think that Fincher does a really good job of storytelling-wise conveying that throughout the film. So, I mean, this last scene, I mean, it's fantastic. I love the way they lay out everything with Alan. Everything makes sense timeline-wise with Alan. But go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say we should talk about the what you could say is the climax of this movie, when Graysmith stares down Arthur Lee Allen
fantastic.
In the hardware store. But before we kind of get this scene foreshadowed, because both Graysmith and Mark Ruffalo's character had said to some effect, you know, I need to see him. I need to look into his eyes, and I need to make sure that it is him.
Such a cool, you
know, like, I need to know. And that's the whole point of this movie. Like, they need to know. But of course, you can't ever really know with this case. And I think they really, really nailed this scene. I don't know what you guys think about this kind of stare down scene, this very silent, subtle scene, but I think it's so well done.
Well, so the first scene with Arthur Lee Allen, when he's at his work, they have the whole thing with the watch. The watch is a very important part of this scene, the Zodiac watch. And Ryan, this is what I was talking about. It's a detail that if Fincher is really this meticulous, it's got to mean something. They talk a whole lot about how he's left-handed, and he wears his watch on his left hand. Which he would not be doing. He would be wearing it on his right. Because you wear it on your non-dominant arm.
Yeah, no, that's true. I am wearing a watch on my left
hand exactly.
Right now.
I wear it on my right. So, like, what's the meaning here?
I don't know. Wait, I can't give you a clear answer on that. I mean, they do say he's ambidextrous, but I guess... maybe this is what Fincher's saying. They were saying with the ambidextrous that he would have been writing with his right hand. So then the watch being on the left hand would be the opposite of the hand that he was writing with. So maybe that's the explanation.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And because then Arthur E. Allen tries to kind of, like, bounce around that. And he's like, no, you know, they tried to force me in school to write with, I guess it was.
My right hand.
With my right hand, but I can't do it. But then I think Fincher is trying to say, okay, no, this is why the handwriting test of matches didn't work out quite correctly. Because he could write with both hands. And I think that's definitely why it's on his left hand.
Yeah, I would say that, yeah, when you initially said it, I was like, I don't know, and then thinking about it, I think that would be the best explanation. Yeah. I think it makes sense.
I think that checks out, too. I think that's a really cool detail. And then they also make a point in that scene of showing us his boots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, no, and again, these little things that Fincher is showing, like, it's probably Alan. Like, just that, he didn't need to do this, but just the shot of just his feet. And it, you don't need to spell it out any more than that.
Tarantino would be proud.
Trusts the art. Tarantino would be proud. He probably wouldn't like that the feet were covered.
Take those boots off.
Take those boots off. Let me see those. Let me see those toenails. But what I love about it is that, like, we say this so many times, that Fincher trusts his audience to pay attention. He knows that all he has to do in that scene is just show a shot of the boots, and we know exactly what he's talking about. And that's why I say that Fincher is such a great film director and such a great visionary director, even if I don't always like his movies. Like, I don't like The Game, I don't like Alien 3, I don't think they're good movies overall, but I always think that Fincher directs well because he has the ability to do this at all times, despite either how great or how bad the story is that he is directing.
Yeah, I never like stuff that talks down to me. If it's a TV show or a movie, I just, it instantly turns me off. If you over-explain, if you I don't know. It's just, if you like explain at all when nothing, when no explanation is necessary, that just, it's an instant turn off. And yeah, I think Fincher is really, you know, I guess, so my issues with, I'm trying to think of if that corresponds to my issues with the other movies. And I think maybe a little bit, like with The Game, very simplistic ending that just kind of wrecked the whole thing for me.
Yeah, I think that's script problems. I don't blame Fincher for that.
No, right. But yeah, no,
he did move it in that direction for that movie. He said that was his idea.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So, but I mean, I think he's
made 10 movies. Not all of them are going to be absolutely perfect, you know? Just because someone's a great director doesn't mean every single decision they make is absolutely perfect, and I don't blame,
they're not all
going to
be winners.
Yeah, they're not all going to be winners.
But he's moving in the right direction with this one. I like where Fincher's going.
Absolutely. And again, I think I don't know if I've said this, but every movie, I mean, I haven't seen Benjamin Button, but the last movies that we're reviewing here, all are good movies. Like, I think the last movie that I gave a bad review, I can't imagine giving another bad review in this series after The Game. Every movie, varying degrees of really good. Okay. Good to great. Is there anything else, Matt? I know this is one of your favorite movies. Is there anything that we missed that you think we should talk about with Zodiac?
I have one tiny thing, and maybe this will, you know, spark something for you, or maybe you can think about what you want to say while I'm asking about this, but there are a lot of blackouts in this movie, like between, and not even like between scenes really, like it makes sense if it were like between murders, but sometimes it's like, you know, a blackout between a shot of someone driving a car and someone like getting out of the car, and it's like, you know, I found that very interesting. It makes it feel like, I almost thought it made it feel like pages in a comic book or something. I know, like, we talked about how Seven had like a sort of comic book origins. Yeah, I found that very interesting. It, like, whenever it would happen, I would be like, oh, okay, that's interesting, you know. And I don't know if it's maybe like a missing piece in what we know in the fact or something like that. It just makes it feel it makes it feel disconnected in the way that it's supposed to be. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts on that are.
Yeah, so first, what it reminded me of, I don't know, Brendan, if you know this game, L.A. Noire, which is it's a Rockstar video game, one of my favorite video games of all time.
Good game.
They kind of use, like, you know, these blackouts that Logan was talking about similarly. So it reminded me, and that also has a very noir feel to it. But for me, now that I think about it, I think what it does so well, we talked about how this movie jumps around in time, and there's a lot that we don't see that is implied. And just having, like, fade-outs from scene rather than just a sharp cut implies that there is more happening in the scene, and that's happening is happening, but we don't get to see it. But, you know, but it implies that something is happening. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically when Arthur Lee Allen pulls up to his trailer, steps out. We know that from that moment, they're going to investigate him, they're going to, you know, search his house further, but we don't see it. It just kind of gives the implication of more happening, which I think for me just kind of, you know, lends to the mystery of it all and the sort of ambiguity of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, again, that's Fincher knowing that he doesn't have to show everything. And again, this movie's 2 hours and 40 minutes. You can't show everything. This movie takes place over 13 years. You can't, you know, 13 years to condense down in 2.5 hours. Actually, this movie feels like it moves very fast despite how long it is. And again, that I think that's because Fincher knows when to start and stop a scene very well. And again, this is from, I think his name's James Vanderbilt. I forget what the writer
is. Yeah, that is his name.
James Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
He's one of two writing things on the movie.
Yeah, maybe this is a script, and again, just, you know, doing the script, but I feel like it's you know, because Fincher does this so often, it definitely feels intentional. But yeah, is there anything else, guys, that you want to talk about with Zodiac before we move into the real-life story with Twisted Mug Mysteries later in the week?
Hey.
Alrighty, well, let's do final thoughts and ratings. Brendan, Zodiac.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting movie. Like I said before, going into it, I was a little intimidated by the runtime. But I was super impressed by, you know, this adaptation. And I think that it does a really great job illustrating the case itself. I think when we get to Twisted Mug Mysteries, I'm going to have a hard time talking about anything that, you know, like, in terms of, like, things that happened other than, like, theories and stuff. There is nothing, in my opinion, besides maybe Robert Graysmith's actual book. There's not a whole lot else that I would point to be like, yes, this is what you should look at if you want to know about the Zodiac killer and those killings. I think that the performances are just really incredible. I think Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., and Mark Ruffalo just really shine in this movie. Just, you know, everything, it's really well directed, really well shot, great score. I don't know. I think that this this is a really excellent movie. I'm going to give it an A. I think it deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it. This is just a masterpiece for me. I love it so much. I could talk about it even more. I'm excited to be on the Twisted Mug Media, or the Twisted Mug, whatever, Mysteries episode and talk some more about this, the facts of the case. You know, I think Fincher does a great job. You know, there's a lot of exposition in this movie. A lot of this movie is just people going around and doing the laborious reporter work, knocking on doors, finding information. Somehow, like All the President's Men, Fincher makes that so damn engaging. And it's something that we didn't really touch on, but I think he makes he condenses all these facts around the Zodiac and all these different perspectives and testimonies. It makes it pretty coherent. It makes it able for us to follow. You know, at times I think he intentionally confuses us and with red herrings and whatnot. But towards the end, when Jake Gyllenhaal is really falling down that rabbit hole, I mean, we kind of understand, we're picking up the breadcrumbs as he does. When he explains to Mark Ruffalo everything, we're realizing, oh, we did not see this in the first half of the movie. This is not something that Mark Ruffalo's character or the police department explored. I think the script does a really good job at kind of simplifying all of it while also still making it very terrifying and with a very, very eerie atmosphere. You know, Fincher's look, Fincher's feel, and the mood of this movie is just so damn brilliant. The camera that never leaves its characters, that's always by their side, that infamous just Fincher pan as they go across buildings and across the reporter room with the low ceiling, so stylized like as it is in All the President's Men. I think this is a remarkably engaging movie, and it's one that really manages to go deeper than just the traditional, I am a crazed serial killer, and I kill people for fun, and that's what the movie is going to focus on. No, it uses that as the foundation then to build off of and to go into something deeper with the characters, which I think is a sign of a really good movie that can go beyond that and say, okay, but this is what it's doing to the characters. This is what that obsession is doing to them. And it really examines that in their lives, very detailed. I like that this movie doesn't really brush over how this affects his marriage. Chloe Savini, who plays his wife, doesn't get sidelined. I think she brings some really great presence in her scenes, and he shows, like, no, his actions have consequences. You know, although what he is doing, it's an admirable thing. We would want to find the killer of these people. As Mark Ruffalo says, more than 200 people have died in the San Francisco area since the Zodiac guy was around. Like, we have other grieving families to take care of. But yet again, you know, like this movie's theme, obsession, by the end of it, Jake Gyllenhaal even manages to rope Mark Ruffalo back into it in the restaurant. He manages to get him back into it. And I think that's so great. I think, like, a great metaphor for all the obsession in this movie is when Jake Gyllenhaal goes and rings on Mark Ruffalo's house. He gets up from bed and he's furious. He says he's going to grab his gun. He's going to call the police. And then slowly he just gets sucked into it. And eventually he's at a diner and they're talking about it. You know what I mean? And he can't escape it. And I think this movie is really about how far we will go to discover the truth. You know, whether at what consequence, and how much that will hurt us or our families, which is, you know, explored in different gradations through Avery Graysmith and the Mark Ruffalo guy. I think this is a masterpiece of a movie. Unless something else changes, this will be my favorite Fincher movie out of the series. For me, this is an A+, an absolute goddamn masterpiece.
Don't count out that wrinkly baby.
I'm not counting out the wrinkly baby or the BDSM-fueled leather-soaked girl with the dragon tattoo.
I think you're going to like that movie.
I think I will too. Movie. I'm excited.
All right. I thought there were some great performances all around. It's very meticulously and ambiguously directed by Fincher, as we've talked about a lot. It never talks down to us, which I absolutely love. And it's not afraid to leave it open-ended. You know, the real-life story is open-ended, and I think it would have been easy for, you know, a lesser Hollywood blockbuster to just tie it up. You know, they would give us an answer or something. But it I love a movie that doesn't need to tie everything up at the end. If I have one teeny-tiny issue with this movie, it's that I think when the murders aren't still actively happening, like we have in, you know, like Seven, and a lot of other of these, you know, like serial killer movies, there's a slight decrease in the stakes of, you know, like, of course he wants to find the answer, but like, it's not super urgent anymore. I don't know. It's such a small issue. But, you know, still watching Gyllenhaal and all of these characters just spiral and, you know, all in very different ways, just kind of going crazy from this case that is, seems to be just unsolvable. It's frustrating to watch in just the best way possible. The fact that Gyllenhaal doesn't want to, or he really wants to solve this and like no one else will help him. He has such a difficult time. With all of the bureaucracy. I think it's a very innovative movie. I love the historical accuracy, and I'm going to give this an A. It is certainly my favorite Fincher movie so far, and I haven't, you know, hadn't seen any of them up to this point before this watch through, and I haven't seen any of the ones that are to come. So, you know, I'm excited. I think Fincher just keeps getting better.
Yeah, I love this movie. I think it's fantastic. I love the first hour of this movie and the hysteria around the murders. I think he shoots the murders perfectly. I can't think of anything that I would do differently. Again, I mean, the focus of this series, you know, is looking at David Fincher as a director, and I think he's definitely maturing in a lot of ways. I do still think that Seven will always be my favorite Fincher movie, and I shouldn't say always. He could always make a movie that I like more. I could like Mank more. I could like whatever he makes after that more, but for right now, I think Seven is going to remain my favorite Fincher movie. But that's not to take anything away from this movie. I think this is one of his best films. I love the performances that he pulls out of his actors always. Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., Mark Ruffalo, all fantastic leads in this movie. I think, like I said, both between their chemistry and Fincher's direction and the script, we feel very connected to them despite the minimal amount of time that we actually get to spend with them getting to learn their personality. I think the last hour and a half is a great dive down a rabbit hole with the characters. I think Fincher does a fantastic job of taking us down that rabbit hole with the characters, and ending very effectively. This movie feels a lot like The Social Network to me, in a lot of ways, in the ways that it portrays what happened. Even though this movie apparently is a lot more accurate than The Social Network. The Social Network is not a very accurate film, but it feels the same in terms of the way it is presented by Fincher. And yeah, I love both of those movies, and we'll talk about The Social Network here in a little bit. But yeah, this movie gets an A for me. I think it's fantastic. And I had said, I didn't bring this back around, the bleakness of the ending. What I love about it is that, yeah, maybe maybe Gray Smith figured it out. Maybe he did. Maybe he put it all together. But then there's still that doubt where it's like, A, if he did figure it out, was it worth it? Was it worth destroying his life over? And B, none of the evidence lines up with it, even if the timeline lines up. So did he really even figure it out? And he dedicated his whole life to it. And I think having that question obviously be the answer is like, no, it wasn't worth it. I think that's why it was so bleak. Like, even the ending of Seven, with the attacked on ending of Somerset staying on the force, saying like, okay, I think that we can, you know, I can still do good. There is nothing left at the end of this movie. It's like, yeah, maybe he's the killer, but also there's a good amount of doubt that he's not, and there's a good chance that, or a great chance that we are never going to figure this out. And I think that's why this movie is so bleak to me, and I think that why this ending of this movie is so helpless, and I love it. Again, Fincher nihilism, it's not always there. I'm sure that Benjamin Button's going to be probably his most hopeful, most positive film, I'm assuming, probably. Just from the source material. And, you know, even The Social Network it's not life or death stakes there. So it's, I mean, he doesn't always go to this edge, but when he does, I think he does it really well. And yeah, this movie gets an A for me. It's fantastic. But real quick, before we talk about all the other shows on our network, especially Twisted Mug Mysteries, where we're going to be talking more about the Zodiac Killer, I do want to just talk about real quick, I forgot to mention at the top of the show, it is completely unrelated to David Fincher, but I feel like it is necessary for us to talk about. At the time of this recording, we were recording this on Saturday. Last night, the news came out that Chadwick Boseman passed away. I'm sure everyone knows this. Black Panther star of 42, Marshall, along with Da Five Bloods that came out earlier this year. Absolute tragic loss. And it really hit me pretty hard. I think it shows us how much we don't know what's going on in people's lives at all time. And it's just... really respect Boseman as an actor, but also as just a person that continued to put others in front of himself. Just he put our entertainment and the entertainment of so many people ahead of his own life, because he pushed through making all these amazing movies while going through cancer treatment. And I think that is just a really inspirational and sad story, and I just wanted to take a moment to recognize Chadwick Boseman at the end of this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. Actor, fantastic guy.
Tragic loss. Terrible news. If 2020 felt like it couldn't get any worse, but...
Yeah, absolutely. So I just wanted to take a moment for us to do that. We don't normally talk about celebrity deaths, but I feel like this one's definitely worth bringing up. And so there's no easy way to transition from there. Next week, we are going to be talking about The Tree of Life, a highly anticipated podcast for us. As we move into a break from our Fincher series, we will be finishing and talking about all the rest of David Fincher's movies. But we didn't want to just talk about David Fincher for 10, 11 weeks in a row. You know, we wanted to break it up. So we are doing... under or overrated picks. So the first one, since I was last time, I will be first this time, and I was pressured into doing The Tree of Life, which is a movie that I wasn't a fan of the first time I saw it. I haven't rewatched it yet. We'll see what I feel. It's one of Matt's favorite movies, and Logan and Brennan haven't seen it. But then after that, we have Logan's pick, I believe, right?
Yes.
After that, we have The Shape of Water.
Next, right, I have The Shape of Water. I saw it in theaters back in, you know, Best Picture winner of what year, Floyd?
2017.
There we go. I figured you'd know. Did not enjoy it for a lot of reasons, so I haven't watched it since then, you know, like Floyd with The Tree of Life, so maybe I'll feel differently about it.
So, we also have, we have The Tree of Life, we have, Shape of Water, Matt's pick Boyhood, and Brennan's pick Haunted Mansion, which we will be plugging. We will be plugging more as we get close to those shows, but we did just find out that apparently they're making a new Haunted Mansion movie, completely unrelated. I cannot believe that it worked out that way.
It's the writer of the Ghostbusters movie that came out a few years ago, and then but she also wrote The Heat, which was a good movie.
That's a funny movie.
So I think that they're gonna. It seems like they're going more towards comedy than because initially there was supposed to be a Guillermo del Toro movie about the Haunted Mansion that was supposed to be very scary. And there's like concept art, you can go check it out, of like the Hatbox ghost that like looks super...
He made that movie, it's called Crimson Peak.
Well, true. Yeah, but then they were going to do it like fully like Disney property. But
I know, I'm just saying, like he made that movie already. Well, like, he doesn't need to make it again with Disney stickers on it.
The release of this series is surprisingly relevant then.
Yeah.
There are so many times.
We are nailing this. So yeah, guys, come back for those shows. Very excited to be doing those shows, and then we will be getting back to David Fincher. But Brennan, do you want to tell us about the other shows on this network?
Of course. In addition to this, our flagship show, we also have the CTP Movie Journal, which is Matt and Ryan's miscellaneous short form movie podcast featuring their best of lists. Best of the Decade just came out a few weeks ago, parts 1 and 2. Go check those out. We have Stop, Wait, What, which is our improv comedy advice show. Latest episode of that just came out. It was great. We had two brand new characters on it. I just wanted to plug really quick. The next time that an episode of that airs will be our first guest, which was one of Logan's friends from college. And it was a super fun time. And I had a really, really great time with your guest, Logan. So thank you so much for bringing him on.
Yes, of course. Yeah, that was a fantastic episode. Look forward to that in a couple weeks.
Yeah. In addition to those shows, however, we have Back in Style, which is our newcomer-friendly episodic review of Twin Peaks. There's Twisted Mug Mysteries, which we talked about before, your one-stop shop for everything spooky and occult, which on Wednesday we'll be releasing our Zodiac Killer episode. Octo Island, our extended universe Star Wars podcast series, and I Might Play That, our video game review podcast.
Yes, and as always, we are on social media. We are at Twisted Mug Media on Instagram and Twitter. Please hit us up there. Go give us a like, give us a follow. We'd really, really greatly appreciate that. As well, please feel free to go into iTunes. Give us a 5-star review if you like the show, what you like about it. Let us know. And if you'd like to email us directly, you can do so at our email, which is twistedpunkmedia@gmail.com. It'd be really, really awesome to hear from you guys. Hear from someone who's real, not just a spam message, which we get quite often. But yeah, we do get a lot of requests for money for people's dying grandmothers and a whole lot of random stuff.
We
in the
say
spam
no,
folder, but we say no, but we will say yes to you if you contact us with an actual response, as whatever it is. It can be mundane or an actual insightful comment.
If you just want to say hi, we'd appreciate that.
If it's just hi, like literally that will suffice, and we'll say hi back. We'll start a conversation. It'll be great. But yeah, thanks for listening, guys. This was awesome. And also, I'm going to be bringing this up many times, but I'm going to plug Mindhunter here, because even though we're not going to be talking about Mindhunter on this series because it's the TV show. It would be the very last thing we talk about. It's going to be, you know, in between, I guess, Gone Girl and Mank. Really great series. Like one of the greatest TV shows I've ever seen, starring Jonathan Groff, who's from our hometown, which is kind of cool. Brilliant, brilliant show that really tonally falls in line with the Zodiac movie in many ways.
Yeah, so come back next week for our review of The Tree of Life, and come back on Wednesday for our Zodiac Killer episode on Twisted Mug Mystery. So thanks for listening, guys. I'm Ryan.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Matthew.
And I'm Logan.
And we'll talk to you next time. See you guys.
See ya.